Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Cigarette smoking has declined significantly since the first Surgeon General's report on the dangers of smoking in 1964. But 50 years later, large disparities have emerged across groups defined by race, ethnicity, educational level, and socioeconomic status, and across regions of the country. In Ohio, for example, where the rate of adult smoking now stands at 23%, compared to a national average of about 19%. We'll take a closer look at Ohio later on in the show. Joining us now to talk about who is smoking, where they smoke, and why, despite a half century of Surgeon General's reports, is Thomas Carr. He's Director of National Policy for the American Lung Association. He joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having us on.
The percent of adults who smoke in the U.S. has been cut by more than half, from more than 42% to 18% since the 1964 Surgeon General's report. But heart disease, cancer, lung ailments, and stroke, all of them often linked with smoking, are the top four leading causes of death. Why do they persist despite the drop or the percentage drop in smoking?
I mean, I think that smoking, it's a disease that it's really deadly for the people that use it. Despite the fact that we've made significant progress since the 1964 Surgeon General's report, it really is it's really still a big problem, with close to half a million people dying each year.
Dr. Thomas Frieden, he's a director of the Centers for Disease Control, said in a recent published commentary that the U.S. lags behind many other countries in adopting measures that have been proven to reduce tobacco use. What isn't the U.S. doing that some of these other countries are?
Well, I think some countries have adopted, and some of this is due to the laws in the U.S. preventing, like the First Amendment, preventing us from doing some of the laws that have been done overseas. But certainly regulating tobacco products is a big thing, and we just gave the U.S. Food and Drug Administration regulatory authority over tobacco products back in 2009, and they've started to take some good steps forward. Although we really want them to issue a regulation that would deem authority over all tobacco products.
So does that authority going to the FDA explain why the FDA is behind this new ad campaign targeted at youth?
Yeah, it's part of it. That was part of the law. It's part of there's never been a real sustained campaign on youth that targets youth on TV. And the tobacco industry spends about $1 million an hour marketing its products. So we really need the FDA's campaign is timely, as well as the TIPS campaign from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has been running for the past couple years.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking to Thomas Carr. He's Director of National Policy for the American Lung Association. We're talking about what's happened in the past 50 years since the first Surgeon General's report on smoking and the damage it does. If you have a question or comment, you can join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Here's something that surprised me. Smokers today have a higher risk of developing lung cancers than did smokers in the 1960s. That's according to a report released last month by the acting U.S. Surgeon General. They say it's changes in design and composition of cigarettes. What are those changes?
That's part of what the FDA will be able to determine once they get a good look at the cigarettes and why FDA regulation is so important. But it's clear that the tobacco industry has been manipulating products over these years to make them more addictive and make it harder for people to quit. It's just tragic to see the 20 million lives that have been lost since 1964, and the fact that it's harder to quit today than it was 50 years ago.
So who was in charge of it? Who had the authority before the FDA?
There was no authority. No one was able to look at the products, regulate the products, at least in the comprehensive way that FDA does. A few states took some action around disclosure of products, but really it was really needed the FDA to take the step and move forward.
Did the tobacco settlement trigger this action, giving the authority to the FDA?
There's a bit of history here. The FDA, the U.S., the federal government decided tried to regulate tobacco products as drug delivery devices back in the late 1990s during the Clinton administration, but that was overturned by the Supreme Court in 2000, I believe. And so the efforts turned to Congress, and that was what passed in 2009. Basically, Congress had to give FDA the specific authority to do so.
And without that, cigarettes have been allowed, or the cigarette makers have been allowed to change them into something even more dangerous.
Yeah, I mean, they've had free reign to do whatever they wanted with their products, manipulate them in ways that, honestly, we just don't know the true scope of.
The U.S. now has more former smokers than current smokers. What has worked best? What do we know works best to get people to try to quit?
Well, I mean, I think the American Lung Association just released our State of Tobacco Control 2014 report, and in that we grade states and the federal government on key tobacco control policies.
Mm-hmm.
And at the state level, we certainly think that tobacco funding, tobacco prevention and cessation programs at CDC recommended levels, smoke-free workplace laws, increasing the price of cigarettes and other tobacco products, and then also providing comprehensive cessation coverage for smokers who want to quit is essential.
And does health insurance cover smoke cessation programs?
It varies by state. If you look at Ohio, there's they've done a good job with covering all 7 FDA recommended medications, and this is under their Medicaid program.
Uh-huh.
But they don't have any coverage for counseling whatsoever. So there are 3 forms of counseling that are recommended by CDC through in the U.S. Public Health Service guideline.
So I want to get back to how cigarettes are more addictive now. Does that mean that maybe that Smoke Stoppers program that I succeeded with, 30 years ago, might not work as well on me today?
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It may not. It really varies from person to person to some extent, too, how strong the addiction is,
uh-huh.
What their motivation for quitting it is as well, too. I mean, there are a lot of factors that go into whether someone can quit or not. But certainly product manipulation is one thing that has been a negative effect.
How do we calculate, how do you calculate from where you sit at the American Lung Association, the costs of smoking to society now?
Well, in the recent U.S. Surgeon General's report that you referenced before, they peg the cost at least $289 billion a year. This is nationwide, but also it could be up as high as $330 billion a year. That's billion with a B. So the costs are just massive from tobacco use, and this is due both to direct medical care and health care costs, but also lost productivity from someone not being able to work because they unfortunately die young.
All right, so let's get to that report card. Oh, for the 5th year in a row, Ohio flunked its report card on smoking cessation efforts in your annual State of Tobacco Control report. Tell us, they received poor grades in 3 areas, 2 Fs, one for tobacco control and prevention funding and the other for coverage for cessation programs by state insurance. So they got an F for the coverage.
Yeah. I mean, part of that is due to the fact that they have a very low investment in their quit line, which is a phone counseling service for smokers who want to quit.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the lowest among states. One of the things that I'd note too is that I heard this from our local person in Ohio that the quit line only serves pregnant women and uninsured people. I mean, and so not everyone can actually access that service, which just points to the lack of funding that is available and the other F that Ohio earned in tobacco prevention and cessation programs.
I would imagine part of the logic, if you want to call it that, is that differences, I mentioned it early on in the program, how there's certain socioeconomic groups, there's large disparities basically by race, ethnicity, educational level, and socioeconomic status. And are smoke-stopping efforts, ad campaigns, do they target those groups well enough yet?
I think clearly in some cases they could do better. in some cases, I mean, one of the really big disparities is actually amongst mentally ill people. They smoke about 44% of the cigarettes in the United States, like overall. So they're very heavy smokers too. So, and that is a particularly tough group to target as far as getting an effective intervention. I think one thing to mention is menthol too. That is also it's been found to make it easier for people to start. It's because it's kind of a starter product, and it dulls the tobacco taste, but it also makes it harder for people to quit as well, too.
I wanted to just bring in right now Dr. Rob Crane. He is a professor at OSU and the president of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. Welcome to the show.
And it's great to be here again. Thank you.
So what do you make of the American Lung Association's annual State of Tobacco Control Report regarding Ohio? Any surprises there?
None whatsoever, unfortunately. We've made no progress since we kind of gave up on tobacco in 2008.
Yeah, they gave up in 2008, yet Ohio is doing better than they are now.
Oh, we had learned the secret. We had really found the special sauce and were knocking down smoking among kids and among adults until the funding was completely taken away.
Is it because you couldn't convince lawmakers that the anti-smoking campaigns were working?
I think it was more that the tobacco industry had convinced through their lobbyists, the legislators, that they had to put a stop to this.
Thomas Carr, does the tobacco industry lobby against efforts to spend tobacco settlement money on anti-smoking campaigns?
They're not supposed to. That doesn't mean they don't, but that was a part of the Master Settlement Agreement, I believe, was they were not supposed to lobby against them. That doesn't mean they don't, and then they could do it in ways that we don't know.
We are going to continue our conversation about Ohio's smoking cessation efforts, where they failed, where they succeeded. With Thomas Carr, Director of National Policy for the American Lung Association, and also Dr. Rob Crane. He's the president of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. If you have any questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The president this morning applauded news that CVS Caremark, the company that owns CVS drugstores, has decided to stop selling cigarettes and other tobacco products in its stores and begin a national campaign to help millions of Americans quit smoking instead. We're talking about the state of the stop smoking efforts in the United States. It is the 50-year anniversary of the first Surgeon General's report that denounced that smoking's bad for you. The Centers for Disease Control report that smoking is down nationally, but Ohio is lagging behind other states these days. What's more, the American Lung Association's annual State of Tobacco Control report gave the Buckeye State an F for tobacco cessation efforts. Why Ohio? We've been talking with Thomas Carr, Director of National Policy for the American Lung Association, by phone from Washington. And also with us in the studio now, Dr. Rob Crane. He is a physician, OSU professor of family medicine, and president of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Rob Crane, the latest national health interview surveys conducted by the Centers for Disease Control say that 23.3% of Ohio residents still smoked in 2012. That's compared to a national rate of about 19%. What happened?
Well, we lost our momentum. We clearly, in 2000 and 2002, we used a small percentage of the money we got from the tobacco settlement, about 3% of it, to start the Tobacco Use Prevention and Control Foundation in Ohio. And that ran for 7 years, and it was enormously effective. They were able to drop youth smoking, the smoking among kids who were in middle school, by about 60%, among high school students by about 30%, and in adults by about 15% in that short period of time. So we had finally found a way through counter-marketing, cessation support, and a variety of other things to slow down this epidemic. Unfortunately, when that momentum was lost, by virtue of having the entire foundation disbanded by Governor Strickland and Speaker of the House Husted, we completely lost our ability.
So it was a bipartisan decimation of the foundation. Thomas Carr, has the same sort of attitude prevailed in other states where they have they been cutting back likewise as they've succeeded at one level thinking, and do they become lackadaisical about it?
Well, in some cases, yeah. We've seen really successful programs be cut. Washington State was an example. They'd actually saved the study had come out that it said they'd had basically it had 5-to-1 return on investment from their tobacco control program from 2000 to 2009, but then they completely have gutted it, and they're only spending about over between $500,000 and $1 million now, and it's real tragic. It's a shame.
And Ohio went down to zero, right, Dr. Crane?
Indeed. Ohio spends almost nothing. And, of course, the meaning for that in Ohio, if you look at the numbers, we lose about 18,000 or so Ohioans each year to tobacco smoking. And if we were at the national rate of 18 or 19%, that would be 4,000 fewer deaths. So we've given up 4,000 lives every year because of our inability to maintain this program.
What do we know about the rate of child smoking in Ohio now that, you know, all these years later?
Also,
it's
rebounded.
You said it dropped by 30%.
It's dropped and then it's gone back up again as well. Unfortunately, we have not been doing our youth surveys as regularly as we ought to in Ohio. I'm not sure why. So we don't know exactly what the numbers are, but we know they're not good.
States this year will receive $25 billion altogether from the tobacco settlement and spent less than 2% on that on smoking cessation programs. What about the tobacco lawsuit money? Thomas Carr, weren't states supposed to spend money from that on smoking cessation?
They made a lot of promises at the time that all of this money was going to be used for to prevent and reduce tobacco use. And some states have to some extent used that money. Florida is actually a good example. And this was through a voter approved constitutional amendment in 2007. They're spending between $60 and $65 million every year, and they now have a youth smoking rate of 8.5%, which is just amazing. It's in the single digits.
So, yeah, in Ohio, we're double that at least. And I think we know the way to get back there. We have the ability to raise taxes on cigarette products, and that would completely fund cessation efforts and youth prevention efforts. But our legislature have got to take that initiative to raise taxes on tobacco and apply it appropriately.
That's another area that you score Ohio poorly on, Thomas Carr.
Yeah, it is. We give them a D. They have $1.25 per pack cigarette tax, and it hasn't been raised in a while. It's certainly a good way to fund tobacco prevention cessation programs, and is the way that it has been done in other states as well.
Can you give me an example of a comparable state to Ohio that's doing a good job in your eyes, that's getting good grades?
It's hard. You can tell from my my thinking about it. A comparable state to Ohio. Florida is a decent example. They have a well-funded tobacco control program, as I said before, and have been making some substantial progress.
California, Mississippi, Massachusetts, all have done well.
Yeah. Maine is actually a smaller state that's done fairly well as well, too. So.
Well, let's take a call from Pam in Clintonville. You're on the air, Pam. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann and doctors. I really appreciate this show. It's so important. I have one comment and one question. The comment is, I'm kind of surprised that it's taken this long for pharmacy to take the step towards not having tobacco products
the
for
CVS,
sale on their show.
The CVS decision,
Yes. To me, it's always been kind of strange that the places where people, smokers, go to get their medication so they can still breathe are the same places where they pick up their cigarettes as a pharmacist. I just couldn't see myself working in that situation. So that was one comment. Another comment is I still am totally confused as how young people are able to get cigarettes. And as your guests know, and I think you've kind of alluded to, most people start smoking when they're underage, and it only takes, I think, 200 cigarettes to get addicted, and that's not a whole mm-hmm. lot. And by the time they're 18 or they're legal, or whatever age it is that they're legal, mm-hmm. they're well on their way to developing a lifelong problem.
Right.
But I'm a physician, and I work with low income people at Heart of Ohio. Currently, and some of my patients, many of whom are uninsured, most of them have expressed a desire to stop smoking, but for financial reasons as well as health reasons, but they just have found it, very difficult to do. And they work temp jobs or minimum wage mm-hmm. jobs if they're able to find work, and so fairly significant portion of their income is going towards purchasing cigarettes, which are, what, $5 a pack now? I'm not even sure, since I don't buy them myself. But my question then is, what can we do, especially in view of the fact that we're not having a lot of tobacco settlement money helping us with this, how can we as healthcare providers and family members and community members, how can we support people that have this desire to stop smoking?
Dr. Crane?
Well, we know, and I think our physician caller certainly knows, the number one reason people quit smoking, their doctor told them to. And all of us in the healthcare profession need to remind ourselves that when a person comes in with a cough or a cancer or heart disease and they're smoking, we need to point out to them the relationship. We need to point out to them that we can support them in their efforts with counseling, with pharmaceutical products that help them quit. And we've got to do that very consistently. The number two reason people quit smoking is their employer went smoke-free. Mm-hmm. And Ohio, of course, has done that. So we need to continue to make that argument and help people get through this terrible addiction.
Thanks a lot, Pam from Clintonville. Appreciate that. Thomas Carr, how big of a deal is it that CVS has decided to stop selling cigarettes and other tobacco products in its stores?
It's an incredibly bold decision. They have 7,600 retail stores nationwide.
It's going to cost them money.
It could cost them money, yes. But I think what they have said is that the fact that they're a healthcare institution and increasingly delivering healthcare for people, it really does make a lot of sense for them not to sell tobacco products. And as the American Lung Association, we certainly encourage other companies that do to take a look at it.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Dr. Crane?
Yeah, I would ask my patients, transfer your prescriptions. I mean, they finally made a bold step. They're giving up $2 billion in revenue to do this, to say that our mission is incompatible with selling cigarettes. We can't sell health and sell death at the same time. And we need to applaud them and support them.
It does create a platform that didn't exist before, because if you need a prescription, you need a prescription, right? Email from a listener. Forgotten in Ohio public health are residents of condos and apartments who breathe major amounts of neighbors' toxic cigarette smoke in their homes. Many people find it economically or physically hard to move from their homes. I think that we should ban all smoking in all existing multifamily housing unless built in the future specifically for smokers.
I think this is a movement that's occurring across the United States, starting in California and on the East Coast as well, especially people who are in tight quarters with in condos or in apartment buildings where you simply can't get away from shared ventilation systems and that smoke is wafting into the apartment. We have to remind ourselves that 50,000 people die every year from OP smoke. That's other people's smoke. And that secondhand smoke is deadly.
Now, lots of hotels now ban smoking everywhere in the hotel. They're all smoke-free. Thomas Carr, is there a trend toward residential housing as well?
Yeah, no, I think especially in the multifamily housing, as you said, we're starting to see it. It's really been, it really started probably maybe even longer than that years ago, and it's been exploding all across the country. I mean, we have public housing authorities, even in the Midwest and places like that are considering it. I mean, it makes business sense for a both, you know, even in a public housing setting or in a privately owned setting as well, too, because it costs so much more to turn over a smoker's unit.
Bryant in Grandview, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Bryant. You quit.
Yes.
Congratulations.
13 months, I decided just to go cold turkey. It wasn't easy, but so what I did was I bought bags of Lifesavers at Kroger's, so every time I had the urge to smoke a cigarette, I just popped the Lifesaver in my mouth. The thing that was really that got me to quit, two things. One, I was hanging around people that didn't smoke, and I didn't realize how offensive the odor is until you quit. But people would comment when I'd show up. They'd go, man, you smell like a pack of cigarettes, and I couldn't smell it at the time. And then the other thing that drove me to, I got out my calculator, started figuring what I was spending on cigarettes, and being a musician, I calculated that if I quit smoking cigarettes, that I would be able to afford a really nice Martin guitar. And I was just overwhelmed by it. The other thing that's weird is when you're a smoker, you're always constantly thinking about buying the pack of cigarettes. Then when your cigarettes are like half gone, you start panicking, you start planning out your next course of action. When am I going to go get a pack of cigarettes? So not only is it the cost of the cigarettes, but it takes up a bunch of your time thinking about it. The gas involved to go to the store to get them, then you need a lighter, you need a match. The other thing that's kind of interesting, I noticed the bar situation, people that drink seem to smoke. And that's the other thing I did was when I quit cigarettes, I quit going to places that to help me stop smoking. I quit going to places.
You can't smoke in bars.
No, but it's weird. There's a lot of bars, though, and I've noticed this in Columbus. They have these, like, little smoker tents. They got these smoker patios.
Yeah.
And so I just quit going to those places, but I noticed that for somebody that, you know, that drinks or goes to a bar, you know, as a musician, you know, there's always, like, some kind of smoking going on.
Yeah.
And so I quit doing that. But the biggest thing was when I calculated the cost, I could not believe, because some cigarettes, they're anywhere between $5 and $7 a pack a day. But that's over $2,000, $22,000 or $2,200 a year.
Yep.
And I thought, that is nuts, you know?
Well, Bryant, thanks a lot for your call, and congratulations.
Yeah, and I encourage other people to just go cold turkey.
Go for it.
That's what you're doing.
Okay. All right. Sure. Thanks a lot, Bryant.
You're welcome.
We have an email from Mike in Clintonville. He writes, it's great to promote healthy living and get Ohioans to stop smoking, but let's not go overboard with legislation that will penalize smokers' rights. Americans are free to choose if they smoke, drink, eat red meat, and get cancer. I support not smoking in public places for my children's sake, but I should have the choice to smoke without exorbitant taxes or fees.
Here's the challenge, I think, to that.
Dr. Crane?
Mm-hmm. When Brian used to go buy a pack of cigarettes for $5, each of the rest of us had to pick up the tab for his health care costs to the tune of $9. So we're paying for smokers, not only with health care issues, but also the broader problem of lack of work product and time away from work. So we are actually paying for smokers, and we need to have them absorb more of those costs.
Whether we ever breathe their smoke or not.
You bet.
Bryant brought up that issue of how smoking controls your life. That is one of the topics of one of the ads that's going to start running next week by way of the new ad campaign put out there by the FDA. We'll listen to another one of those ads coming up in a little while, so you might want to stay tuned for that. Ann in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. What an interesting program. I quit smoking 38 years ago, but I did it cold turkey, and it was extremely difficult. 3 years after I quit, my husband decided to quit, and he went on a program that was at Riverside Hospital run by a retired nurse. Our dentist had told us about it. And he had such an easy time getting off that I was stunned. And this nurse's theory was that an animal protein bonded with nicotine, and that if you went on a plant-based diet for 2 weeks, you could break the cycle by having the nicotine go from your body slowly, because she felt that when you ate a meat meal, you got so much protein that it pulled the nicotine from your body, and you craved that cigarette and couldn't, you know,
I don't know, doctor,
fight the craving. Well, so I wondered what the doctors felt about that. It just amazed me how easily he, and without the same stress and mental anguish that I went through.
Yeah.
We know that supportive programs clearly help. Now, I'm not aware of this protein theory, but certainly plant-based diets are healthy, and we should support those. But anything that helps people move off, whether it's counseling or the new pharmaceuticals that will help reduce those cravings.
I have one thing to note, too, actually, is so there's actually research out there that shows, this was something interesting, one of the Prodigy scholars said, was stuff out there that coffee, alcohol, and actually I think red meat maybe too, makes it easy. It actually reacts with cigarette smoking and makes it more pleasurable. So there, that may be something too.
And is it possible that it's something that they've added to the cigarettes that makes that so? We don't know.
It's possible. I mean, we haven't known for the past 50 years, or at least the past. I mean, we still don't have a complete understanding, but at least we have FDA to take a look at it now.
Okay. Ann in Clintonville, thanks a lot for that call. We have a couple emails coming up. Again, we're going to listen to one of those ads put out there by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. They're launching a new campaign aimed at young smokers and would-be smokers. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 50 years ago, the U.S. Surgeon General released the first report linking lung cancer to smoking tobacco. Since then, the number of smokers in the U.S. has decreased, but some states have fared better than others. And the rate of youth smoking has led the U.S. Food and Drug Administration to launch a new campaign aimed at young smokers and would-be smokers. In this ad, a young man approaches a convenience store counter with a wad of cash.
Pack of cigarettes, please.
It's not enough.
What's a pack of smokes cost? Your teeth. Smoking can cause serious gum disease that makes you more likely to lose them. What are cigarettes costing you?
Still with us, Thomas Carr, Director of National Policy for the American Lung Association. And in the studio is Dr. Rob Crane, President of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. You know, Thomas Carr, they're appealing to things other than lung-related diseases now, particularly when they're targeting youth.
I think especially with this ad campaign and the FDA ad campaign, they're trying to target youth 12 to 17 years old. Mm-hmm. And the target audience makes a difference because lung cancer is a disease that's built up over years and years of time, and really what you need to do is to stop them from. You want youth to reconsider the decision to start is basically what you want them to do, and pointing out some of the shorter term effects like, and I'll be honest, I saw that TV ad yesterday, and it's gruesome.
Yeah, for the folks who haven't seen it, he's taking a pair of pliers and pulling out a tooth. And from his jaw, and then giving it to the convenience store clerk. So there you go. It'll cost you more than a bunch of money. It'll cost you your gums, your teeth, and many other aspects of your health. Another one of them has a girl tearing off skin off of her face, which is, I have not seen that yet, and I don't know if I want to, but the point being that, you know, I guess they're shooting for the vanity. The aspect of it.
And I'll note, FDA tested this with a lot of teens, and they thought that the other kind of theme they're working with is the loss of control and the addiction too. So that's
Which is something that Brian or I think it was Brian. I'm not sure who brought up a little bit earlier. Dr. Crane?
Well, just a reminder that, you know, I always tell kids about their teeth and their skin, and also remind them that they'll lose their ability to have an erection as they smoke more and more. And that gets them, I think, where
they're
thinking
about it. There's lots of new reasons not to smoke. They're always learning new ones, liver disease, diabetes. What is the connection with diabetes, Dr. Crane? What have they found?
We were thoughtful about this for a long time because we saw so many diabetics did smoke. And now we're clear that actually smoking promotes the development of diabetes. And that's a double whammy for the cardiovascular system, because the diabetes is a terrible irritant to the heart and the blood vessels, and smoking is like adding gasoline to that fire.
And then also, as you said, male sexual function, erectile dysfunction, rheumatoid arthritis, again, an inflammatory problem. A lot of it goes back to this, immune function.
Right. And two new cancers that we hadn't been sure of before. Now we know that colon cancer is brought on by smoking, as well as liver cancer.
Obviously, tuberculosis, that makes a lot of sense to me, but it's a new discovery that there's a direct link.
Right. If you get TB, you're much more likely. Go ahead.
Thomas Carr?
Okay, yes. TB, that it's actually not that it causes TB, it actually brings on the onset of the disease if you have it already.
Gotcha.
So I just want to make sure. I don't know that, but yeah.
Age-related macular degeneration, which is an eye problem. What?
The number two cause of blindness in the United States. Age-related
diabetes?
Diabetes as well, of course, is brought on by smoking. But macular degeneration is an old person's inability to see after a while is clearly brought on by smoking.
We have an email from Steve, asks, was the money taken from the tobacco settlement to offset the huge budget deficit that Governor Strickland was dealing with during the financial crisis? The agreement with companies clearly stated the money would be used for anti-smoking programs. The state legislature had to pass legislation to move the money into the general fund. That was right. Right, Dr. Crane?
Unfortunately, that's not true.
Okay.
It was a voluntary thing in the states. There was no actual legal reason that the states had to do it. But the governor at the time decided that we should do that and put 3% aside, and it was working. There was not a deficit that he was working with. This all went toward a stimulus program. But, of course, there was a lawsuit, so the stimulus never came.
Email from Carl. There were some really troubling TV ads late last spring showing a woman who had throat surgery putting her wig on and then talking about her smoking causing her cancer. What happened to those ads? Are you familiar with those, Thomas Carr?
Yeah. So actually, just this past Monday, they're starting up again, and you may start to see them again. It isn't a sustained campaign. So for the next 9 weeks, and then there will be another phase that they're doing this year later on. But this one is primarily people that have been ads that have been run before. But there is a couple from Terry Hall, who is the person with the wig and the throat cancer. She actually passed away recently, sadly. So at age 53.
Wow.
So So it's really sad. But she had a couple filmed right before she died. And I have not looked at them myself. I'm not sure I'd want to. But I imagine they're very, very powerful.
That's Thomas Carr, director of the National Policy for the American Lung Association. Also with us, Dr. Rob Crane, professor at OSU, physician and president of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. Let's talk about electronic cigarettes. There's a bill that would prohibit sales of e-cigarettes to those younger than 18. Also, it defines them as alternative nicotine product rather than as a tobacco product. That has bothered anti-tobacco people and groups in the state of Ohio. Dr. Crane, why is that?
Well, e-cigarettes pose a kind of a double-edged sword. For those people who are able to reduce who are addicted to cigarettes, who reduce their use of cigarettes by using e-cigarettes, that's probably helpful to their health. And if they can quit using e-cigarettes, that's probably helpful as well. The other side of that coin is that e-cigarettes are totally unregulated. It's a rogue industry. Most of them are made in China. We have no idea what's inside them. Moreover, they're being sold to kids. About a third of kids who start nicotine start with these cigarettes now.
And there's no restrictions on that
at
this point.
Okay. And what the e-cigarette industry would like to do is quote, ban them before age 18. But they'd also like a carve-out so they don't have to pay the kind of taxes that cigarettes face. And most of these cigarettes companies are now being bought up by the tobacco companies.
Which the definition creates that carve-out.
Exactly.
Yeah, and actually the definition, it may not be just e-cigarettes. It actually may cover a few other tobacco products as well, although the tobacco industry won't say that, like snus and dissolvables. But they want those to be defined separately, too, so they can try to reduce the tax on them as well.
Adam in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Adam.
Hi. I think I have a pretty good understanding how diabetes is caused, but I don't get this direct link on how nicotine is causing diabetes. I get how they don't work well together against the cardiovascular system, but I don't see how it specifically causes it.
I don't think we know the exact etiology. We do know that cigarettes cause a dramatic increase in inflammation in the body. And because the pancreatic islet cells are being attacked by the body itself, and the receptors on the rest of the body also come under attack, probably that inflammatory part of smoking cigarettes is promoting diabetes.
Oh, okay. I got it.
All right.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Bob in Marysville, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi. I'm an ex-smoker, and I appreciate your program. I actually quit 30 years ago, and I was at Cold Turkey after 5 packs a day.
Oof.
Oh, yeah. Camel, non-filter. They were like candy. My thought, and I agree with everything you're saying as far as the adverse effects, but my question is, why doesn't the Lung Association and others just criminalize it and say, hey, we're going to be like Prohibition. You're not allowed to sell cigarettes. You're not allowed to smoke them. You're not allowed to grow tobacco. I think we're sort of dancing around the issue when we say we're going to stop it. We know it's bad. Let's just stop it.
I think it's a very important point you raise. But, of course, we have 43 million addicted American smokers.
Well,
try to stop them overnight would be a challenge.
I taper them down.
Well, that's what you're trying to do, right, isn't it?
Right. I think giving people an opportunity to quit, helping them with their addiction, and most importantly, preventing kids from starting. Right now, there are 5.6 million American kids who will start cigarettes in the next few years who will then die from their addiction. We've got to stop that.
Yeah, I mean, I'll add to that. The easiest way to stop this is to prevent kids from starting. And I'll say that the policy recommendations we make in our state tobacco control report are a good way to start. I think our elected officials have let us down and have not implemented the policies that can really drive down smoking rates.
Okay, Bob, thanks a lot for that call. Lisa in Johnstown, you're on the air. Welcome. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
My comment and question was in regard to residential housing and restrictions. I am currently at the end of treatments for stage 3 lung cancer, and I'm a non-smoker, never smoked in my entire life, never really around that, you know, much secondhand smoke. As a child, you know, family members would smoke, but I wasn't around them consistently. We lived in an apartment recently where the resident previous to us had been long-term resident and had been a heavy smoker. And so when we moved in, you know.
Oh, rats. We just lost Lisa. If you can call us back, but Rob Crane?
I think Lisa's talking about third-hand smoke. You know, that smoke that off-gasses from a person's clothing or
carpeting.
Room or carpeting you've been in. We know that 3,000 non-smokers who are exposed to secondhand smoke die from lung cancer every year. 3,000 from secondhand smoke
to
lung cancer.
That's being around somebody who smokes.
Right. And but this third-hand smoke is just now being studied more. We do know that the off-gasses are toxic. And of course, we've got to keep people from smoking in homes.
And I mean, secondhand, and like we were discussing earlier, making sure that if prohibiting smoking in housing is one way, either voluntarily or through legislation in some places.
Well, I suppose at least you would want a declaration of whether someone has been a smoker in a house, and at least know before you buy it or rent it or whatever.
Yeah, there are a couple of states that have actually done that. Maine, at least with rental housing, Maine and Oregon have laws that require a person to disclose whether smoking has been allowed in a unit before. That's certainly something that states should consider, too.
Go ahead.
And a reminder, in terms of secondhand smoke, kids are the major victims of secondhand smoke. And parents who smoke, they've got to smoke outside, try to quit if they can. But about 1 million Ohio kids are exposed to secondhand smoke on a regular basis, and we've just got to ask parents not to commit child abuse on your kids by smoking around them.
The report, the Surgeon General's report for this year, also has some pretty bad news for women who are current smokers. For the first time ever, they are as likely as men to die from any diseases caused by smoking, especially from coronary heart disease. Why have the risks increased so much? Why does that happen?
Well, for the longest time, women didn't smoke at the same rate that men do.
Okay.
And now we find that as their rates have risen several decades have passed, they've managed to catch up with men and probably will surpass men in certain ways in terms of vulnerability to smoking-related diseases. But it's a tragedy. We'll all remember the Virginia Slims campaign mm-hmm. and others that were directed at women and were unfortunately very effective.
Yeah, after the 64 Surgeon General's report was released, smoking continued to go up among women actually for a little while. It then did start to go down, and part of that is due to those campaigns that Dr. Crane just mentioned.
A couple of quick emails, one from Rick in Westerville. I quit smoking over 30 years ago, and one of the driving factors was I read a book that listed all the hundreds of chemicals that were added both to the tobacco and cigarette paper. So the papers that they use to make them burn.
The new Surgeon General's report actually says there are 7,000 different chemicals found in cigarettes, and many of them are additives. Many of them are just part of the tobacco and the paper themselves that are not good to have in your lungs.
And one thing I'll add to that, I mean, people think that cigarettes are simple. They're just like a piece of paper wrapped around some tobacco and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. These are highly engineered products. The tobacco industry has spent 50 years or even longer honing. And they deliver nicotine deep into the lungs and make it harder for people to quit.
Email from Mike. He says, I find that e-cigarettes cause about as much nausea as regular cigarettes, so I believe they should be regulated, including protection from sidestream smoke. Are they treated the same in public places, airports, and planes? I do know that the OSU smoking ban also bans e-cigarettes. I'm pretty sure it does because of the impression it gives.
Of course, e-cigarettes have just exploded over the last couple of years. And the laws and policies have not really kept up with them. Mm-hmm. We don't know much about them. Again, they're mostly imported, and the cigarette companies, of course, are buying them up rapidly. But that danger of not having any kind of knowledge or regulation about them is persistent.
Yeah, I mean, I think this speaks to the need for FDA. There's a proposal pending right now at the White House to regulate all tobacco products, including e-cigarettes and others like cigars. Mm-hmm. Basically, the FDA had to assert authority over them before they can start actually regulating them. That's part of the 2009 law. But what we need the Obama administration to do is give the green light to FDA to be able to do that. That's where it is right now.
And okay, so the Obama administration has not yet given the FDA the green light.
No, yeah, it's sitting in their Office of Management and Budget in the White House.
It's a long
involved
process, and the FDA has been dragging its feet, and the White House has been dragging its feet for a long time on this.
Well, we have a new ad campaign set to launch in a few days. It's not going to last forever. I think it's about a year long. When there's a new batch of children born every year, do you think that the ad campaigns are something that we can ever end? Thomas Carr?
Well, I mean, I think in the Surgeon General's report, we found that sustained campaigns that run all year long, really, I mean, the tobacco industry doesn't take a break. And so, I mean, we need to find a way to be able to sustain some of these campaigns and make them more. I mean, we've seen the impact just from the Tips from Former Smokers campaign that CDC runs that doesn't even last all year. From the first Tips campaign, 100,000 people quit smoking just from that campaign, which ran about 12 weeks, I think, mm-hmm. maybe 16 weeks. So,
Thomas Carr from the American Lung Association, thanks so much for joining us.
One last thing to plug about kids, and that's Raising the Age to 21, just done in New York City, also done in Hawaii. We should see more of that to keep the kids away from smoking.
Okay. Dr. Rob Crane, thanks for joining us as well today.
Thank you very much for having me, Ann.
Dr. Rob Crane, professor at OSU, physician and president of the Preventing Tobacco Addiction Foundation. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.